Otro top.
Now, to the Fitzwilliam project was started largely to expose that particular case of the Lynette White inquiry, but the causes never went away. Once we actually achieved our aims through the publication of that book, which was to force an investigation of the particular case, try and find the real murderer, but also to develop where what had gone wrong. And it is actually a case of, it is absolutely wrong to say that it is all the fault of South Wales Police, even in the original investigation. Part of the reason I say that is that if you actually examine the history of miscarriages of justice in South Wales, you can trace back to the Merthyr riot, the uprising of 1831, that the methods used in that case led to the execution of a man called Dick Penderyn, or Richard Lewis. He is actually completely innocent. Many years after he was executed, and he was actually executed on perjured evidence, which they knew was perjured, and it was on the orders of the then Home Secretary, later to become Lord Melbourne, that this occurred. But 43 years after Dick Penderyn was executed, the real perpetrator, and it wasn't even murder, it was a person was stabbed in the leg with a bayonet, and he didn't actually identify Penderyn. The real person responsible was a man called Iantu Parker, and he confessed on his deathbed that it was actually him and that he feared execution or transportation. Despite this, it's never been corrected. But the methods used are exactly the same that you see in 1952 in the last execution in Cardiff Prison of a man called Mahmoud Matan. He too turned out to be completely innocent. But what is interesting and important about all of this is the investigative methods that they used were the same, and they were passed down the generations. And these were spectacularly effective. They managed to get convictions. They managed to get people promoted. They managed to get them commended. Why on earth would you change these methods if you think they're working? And the rest of the criminal justice system is congratulating you and patting you on the back and saying, well done, you've done a great job. You have no reason to change. And this is the real problem, because the ultimate responsibility for what has happened is really that of the criminal justice system. It should have prevented this from happening. The evidence that was put before the Crown Prosecution Service in 1989 actually shows, if you examine their code for Crown prosecutors and criteria for sufficiency of evidence, that this case should never have been prosecuted. The same applies to the lawyers who failed to bring to light important information. Right through the criminal justice system, from the police through to the Crown Prosecution Service, the lawyers, the judges, and even the Court of Appeal, it failed to prevent an obvious miscarriage of justice. If any of them had done their job properly, then this case doesn't happen. And if this case doesn't happen, the methods that are used in this case get through to the police that you simply can't do this. And as soon as they understand that, they change their methods. And that means you don't have cases like this occurring. That is what was our aims from this process. In the end, what has happened is the biggest ever investigation of what went wrong in a miscarriage of justice has started. It began in July 2003, and it is still ongoing. It resulted in 34 people being arrested and interviewed under caution on a number of offences such as perjury and conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. In 2008, three witnesses who said they saw the Cardiff Five either in the flat or committing the murder were jailed for perjury. Subsequent to that, of the 34 people, 20 of them were police officers involved in this investigation. 13 of them were told they were going to be tried for conspiracy to pervert the course of justice, and two more witnesses were charged with perjury. That trial is going on now in Swansea, of 8 of them and the two witnesses. This is important in terms of establishing what happened and learning the lessons so that this can be prevented. But what is really interesting about this is in Britain, there are 6 cases which are identical, i.e. where they have found the real perpetrator after a miscarriage of justice in a homicide case. But only one case has an investigation of what went wrong. And that means the opportunity to learn the lessons that should be learned. Because if you don't look at these cases, if you don't establish these mistakes, then you're going to repeat them. And if you look at around the world, the United States alone has 116 cases, according to the Innocence Project, where they say the real perpetrator has been found after a miscarriage of justice. But, and most of these have been proved by DNA. But again, there is no investigation of what went wrong. And this is what I term the importance of vindication, because it is in these cases that you get the opportunity to change the criminal justice system for the better. And that is in everybody's interest, including the police's, because it restores confidence. If people believe that wrongdoing will be prosecuted no matter who is responsible for it, or at least the lessons learned from it, then they will have confidence in the system. But if you have a system where no matter how many times you get things wrong, nothing ever seems to change, nobody ever seems to be held accountable for it, then don't be surprised if you don't have confidence in that system. Now, to move on to the...
Okay. Bueno, ahora él está hablando sobre la importancia de estos de los casos donde las personas son absueltas, es decir, que han sido acusadas erróneamente y finalmente por diferentes métodos forenses pues se ha probado su inocencia. Él lo que dice pues es que eso es lo que hace su organización, ayuda a promover no solamente en encontrar o buscar la absolución de estas personas, sino también en crear conciencia en los sistemas judiciales de qué fue lo que pasó, por qué en un momento dado se cometieron errores y qué se debe hacer para no volverlos a cometer. Él menciona que tiene noticias de errores de justicia desde 1851, cuando a un señor lo acusaron de herir a otro y finalmente pues fue ejecutado de forma errónea, y el real agresor confesó su crimen cuando iba a morir, y pues es el primero. Y de así se ha repetido este problema en la historia británica a través de los años. Y el problema es que como no ha habido alguien que pues como que ponga el dedo en la llaga y les haga ver, bueno, pasó este error, pero ¿qué debemos hacer para no volverlo a cometer? Entonces los métodos de investigación policiales siguen siendo más o menos iguales y se siguen cometiendo los mismos errores. Porque pues se soluciona un caso, se tiene un convicto, la policía obtiene ascensos, felicitaciones y todo está perfecto, pero cuando realmente hay cosas que deben ser remediadas. Otra cosa importante de los casos de reivindicación es que también trae a la justicia aquellas personas que en un determinado momento han intervenido en esos casos, ya sea cometiendo perjurio o obstrucción a la justicia. De hecho, los casos que han sido resueltos en la justicia británica de absolución, en este momento el caso como el que nos comentó inicialmente, llevó a 5 personas a la cárcel por cometer perjurio y otras 3 se encuentran en la cárcel por obstrucción de la justicia, sin tener nada que ver con el crimen realmente. Ellas no son actores, sino pues simplemente se prestaron para armar la película de alguna forma. Entonces este es el proyecto. En el momento, en el Reino Unido, hay 6 casos similares Sin embargo, en solo uno se ha reabierto o se ha abierto la investigación paralela de qué es lo que está pasando, de qué ha pasado mal. En los otros casos, si bien es cierto, se ha obtenido la absolución de las personas, no, la policía no ha abierto una investigación sobre qué es lo que pasó, qué pasó, qué errores se cometieron, y pues ellos simplemente aducen el error se cometió, aprendimos la lección y no lo volveremos a hacer, pero no se ha abierto una investigación. También menciona de que en el Estados Unidos hay aproximadamente unos 160 casos que tienen más o menos el mismo estilo, donde hay personas que podrían ser absueltas por crímenes que no cometieron.
If I could now deal with two of the British Vindication cases that affect the use of a national DNA database. The first of them is one of the most disgraceful miscarriages of justice in British history, possibly even in the world. I don't know if you've ever heard of a man named Stefan Kishko, but he was the victim of a scandalous and disgraceful travesty of justice. What happened is an 11-year-old girl named Leslie Molseed was murdered, and an early clue was that the murderer had ejaculated on her clothing. It is actually known back in 1975 when this happened that Stefan Kishko could not produce semen. Despite this, this never came out in court, and he was advised to effectively plead guilty to manslaughter on diminished responsibility when he was actually totally innocent. And they actually ran a ridiculous defense of doing this, of trying to get diminished responsibility while saying he's got an alibi. The end result of this is that DNA eventually, after 16 years, it was proven that this all came out, that he couldn't produce semen and that he was absolutely, obviously innocent, but that he had endured vicious beatings in prison, been driven to paranoid schizophrenia, where he believed that the government was actually conducting an experiment on to see what the effects of imprisonment would be on tax employees. And was so damaged by his experience that even when the Court of Appeal quashed his conviction, he wasn't immediately released. He was still held in a hospital trying to help him recover. But it was impossible. This man was never going to recover. He never had the resources and thrown in the right direction to actually do this. There was no method to help him rebuild his life at that time. Now there is a limited scheme provided for victims of miscarriages of justice, which he would qualify for, but it's nowhere near sufficient to cater for his needs. Now, that all happened in 1992 and 1993. By 1993, unfortunately, at the age of 41, Stefan Kishko died, an innocent man. His life absolutely ruined. And shortly afterwards, his mother, who had campaigned for him for all of the time that he was in prison, also died. This is one of the biggest tragedies in British legal history, as it was so obviously preventable. Eventually, in 2007, this case was resolved because of the National DNA Database in the UK. A man named Ronald Castry was accused of unrelated offences, which were not proceeded with, but his DNA was put on the National DNA Database. It provided a direct hit to the crime scene samples in the Leslie Molseed case. In 2007, he was successfully prosecuted for this, but as occurred in the Lynette White case, they didn't take into account properly what had happened to the innocent people. In the earlier case, i.e. the Cardiff 5 case, they did 16 years in prison between them for a crime that they did not commit. The real murderer's tariff was 13 years. Despite saying that this was the most important aggravating circumstance, the method under Schedule 21 of the Criminal Justice Act of 2003 doesn't take this into account properly, and that is why we have this project called Just Tariffs. We deal with the issue in the Kishko case because if you look at his tariff, Castries, it's 30 years, exactly the same as the starting point for the murder of a child with sexual conduct and sadistic conduct to it. In other words, either the mitigating circumstances were exactly the same as the aggravating circumstances, which is hard to credit because he didn't plead guilty, he didn't take any responsibility, and there actually doesn't seem to be any mitigation whatsoever. Or, equally outrageously, what happened to Stephen Kishko did not merit a single day in terms of the tariff when the judge, if we are to believe what we are told of about Schedule 21, the judge had the power to do something about this. So either it's insufficient or it is just not work, judges are not implementing it properly. And this is one of the things I would like to talk to some of you about afterwards and conduct interviews about this, because we are conducting a research project on this very issue, which we hope is going to change this situation and take this into account. As the idea of just tariffs is that you have to provide two things. One, deterrence, so people who are actually guilty have a reason to fear not coming forward and allowing innocent people to go to prison on their behalf. And two, provide an incentive. In other words, if you come forward and you prevent or correct a miscarriage of justice from happening, then it will be taken into account and your tariff will be reduced accordingly.
Bueno, él ahora pasa a otro caso que considera el peor caso de injusticia en la justicia británica, que sucedió en 1993 con Stephen Kishko, que fue acusado de violar y de asaltar sexualmente y tener conductas sadísticas con una menor de 11 años y finalmente la asesinó. Y supuestamente al final de todo esto él eyaculó sobre ella. Sin embargo, posteriormente se pudo probar en la corte que él era incapaz de producir semen. Sin embargo, esto no fue tenido en cuenta por la corte y la corte hizo todo y el fiscal hizo todo lo posible para obtener una condena para esta persona, quien efectivamente fue condenada. Él estuvo en la cárcel por varios años, donde sufrió pues todo lo que le pasa a una persona que es acusada de estos delitos en la cárcel. Fue golpeado, fue maltratado por sus por los compañeros en la prisión y debido a todos estos maltratos se volvió bipolar. Finalmente, cuando el caso se reabrió unos años más tarde, fue liberado y pues lo pusieron en un hospital psiquiátrico donde nunca se logró recuperar y finalmente murió. Su madre también, pues viendo esta injusticia, empezó una campaña con la ayuda del proyecto de ellos para reivindicar de cierta forma el nombre de su hijo, pero hasta el momento no ha sido posible. Posteriormente, unos años más tarde, en el año 2003, más o menos, 2007, una persona fue detenida por un cargo que no tenía nada que ver con esto y su DNA fue puesto en la base de datos y surgió el 100% de match entre la muestra de esta persona y la muestra de semen que se encontró en la niña. Entonces, en este momento, pues está el caso andando sobre este verdadero culpable, pero lo que es más vergonzoso de este caso es que el nombre de Stephen Kishko quedó manchado por siempre y pues el hombre pues ya murió y no, pues ya no hubo nada que hacer.
The next case I'm going to deal with will be the one after which I will take some questions if you have any. But please bear in mind on these questions that I will still have another sort of topic to deal with, which I hope I can do in about 10 minutes after that. And then you can ask any other questions you have. The next case that I'm going to deal with, it also occurred in South Wales. And this was the murder of a young 34-year-old woman by the name of Karen Skipper. The facts of this case is that in March of 1996, her body was discovered tied up, naked from the waist down, and she had drowned in the River Ely. Originally, the police suspected her husband, the late Philip Skipper, of this offence. And 5 weeks into the inquiry, they charged him with her murder. The case against him was at best circumstantial, and it was essentially based on there had been arguments with that they had a strange relationship in that they had actually divorced but were still had sort of found each other again and were living together while having other partners. And it's a complicated sort of situation that they sort of knew about. And the situation with this is that back in 1996, they knew about some blood that was on, which later proves to be absolutely crucial, as this blood was on the pocket lining, but on the side that is closest to the skin. And the scientists later said that it could not have soaked through because there was more blood on that side of the pocket lining than there was on the inside, which is none of the scientists expected would have happened had this actually soaked through. There should have been signs of it. Now this is essentially telling you that the blood was deposited almost certainly during the murder. The alternative that the police at that time focused on was that the blood had always been there. But there was an obvious problem with this, because she bought these jeans at a market. They actually traced where they were bought, so they knew the date and time that they were bought. And for that hypothesis that it had been there all along to hold any truth to it, it meant she'd never washed those jeans at all before wearing them. Well, how likely is that? That if you buy a pair of second-hand jeans, that over 2 months later, you've never washed them? It's really hard to believe that. And if you had actually followed this and looked at the evidence in a proper and integrated fashion, it should have told you even then that what you are dealing with is a significant stain, a blood stain that was absolutely significant, and DNA proved it had not come from Karen Skipper and it had not come from Philip Skipper. And that essentially was telling you even then in 1996, this is the blood of the murderer. But they didn't pursue it in that manner. So Philip Skipper stands trial. The evidence against him, as I said, is largely circumstantial, and he is acquitted. But the evidence that actually would have properly vindicated him, even then, while he was alive, wasn't presented properly. And it later has dire consequences. As the investigation carries on, sadly, Philip Skipper dies of cancer in 2004, aged just 48. And he left behind a young daughter. The daughter had only just been born when Karen Skipper died. So she didn't know that her father had stood trial. She didn't know the facts about what had happened to Karen Skipper. And this was effectively forced upon her because a man named John Pope had been arrested on an unrelated offence, which did not result in his conviction. It wasn't even proceeded with, I believe. But that allowed his DNA to be stored on the National DNA Database. They found that he was this match to John Pope, who had been questioned originally and claimed he had never met Karen Skipper. He now has to change his story. And the story he comes up with is that he had actually met Karen Skipper 3 weeks earlier, and that her dog had bitten him, and that she'd given him a tissue, and somehow his blood had been transferred by her into this, and that's how it was explained. In order to explain the problem, that and he then stands trial and is convicted in 2009. But his defense was that, well, he didn't do it, and Philip Skipper did. Despite having been acquitted of this crime, this trial of John Pope effectively turned into a retrial of Philip Skipper. Then, in 2010, after he was convicted, a witness comes forward claiming that she had seen Philip Skipper following his wife on the night of the murder, within a minute or two of that happening. And this witness claims she remembered this 13 years afterwards. Her story really does not hold water at all. It is absolute nonsense. But it helped to secure a retrial. So yet again, the appeal effectively blames Philip Skipper for a crime that he has been acquitted of. And he's no longer alive to defend himself and answer questions in relation to this. The retrial occurred in June and July of this year, and it was the most vitriolic. You know, I actually attended this trial, and it was supposed to have been the retrial of John Pope, but in reality it was the third trial of the late Philip Skipper. And a number of mistakes were made. One of them is that even though the prosecution knew the defense tactic was going to be to attack Philip Skipper and suggest that he was responsible, they did not see the need to state and call witnesses to prove that Philip Skipper was innocent. And this is what you actually had to do. It got very, very close with this attack. And the attack that was put on Skipper, what you have to bear in mind is, they had a presumption of innocence that was allegedly never taken away from Philip Skipper because he was actually acquitted at trial. But if you actually observe that third trial of Philip Skipper, the retrial of John Pope, what you saw was a man who was no longer alive being put on trial for a crime that he was acquitted of, that he was allegedly being presumed innocent of, and there was no safeguards whatsoever. The defense were even able to suggest, if you think Philip Skipper could have done it, then you should acquit my client, Mr. Pope. This is outrageous. It effectively means that an acquittal means absolutely nothing. If the prosecution had tried to do what the defense did in that case, they would have been called to task over it. There is no way that they would have even got a prosecution of Philip Skipper off the ground under these circumstances, because they would basically be saying, we want to produce a case which is entirely circumstantial, one which has been rejected previously, but what we have got now is a witness who claims to have seen him follow her 14 years afterwards. Oh, and by the way, we have a DNA match to somebody else. And this is the key point. Pope's defense became absolutely ridiculous because he claimed that the blood had rehydrated because of dew, but there were no chemical signs of this rehydration. Eventually, the jury rejected it, and he was convicted again. It could easily have gone the other way. There are tariff issues on that, but I'll leave it at that.
Este es acerca de un caso que ocurrió en 1996 en una señora Skipper. Su cuerpo fue encontrado en el río, ahogada, con las manos atadas en la espalda con la cuerda de su perro, y además estaba encadenada. El primer sospechoso fue su esposo. Pues debido a que la relación era entre ellos era un poco extraña, entonces pues todo indicaba que era él. Además de esto, se encontraron una muestra de sangre en la parte más interior del pantalón de ella, pero esta muestra fue un no fue tenida en cuenta porque pues cuando hicieron la confrontación de esa muestra con el DNA del esposo, no había un 100% de coincidencia, pero sin embargo la policía no mencionó esto, sino que lo guardó. Posteriormente, cuando esta prueba salió a la luz, la policía alegó que, según sus investigaciones, la señora había comprado este pantalón de segunda y que es muy probable que esa mancha ya estuviera ahí y que ella nunca se tomó el trabajo de lavarla, sino que lo usó y pues por eso era la explicación de que esa mancha estaba ahí. El sistema judicial siguió adelante y finalmente condenó al esposo. Sin embargo, el peso de la prueba no era lo suficientemente bueno y el caso se cayó y él finalmente fue absuelto. Murió de cáncer unos años después, pero quedó una hija que quedó prácticamente huérfana. En el año 2009, de forma muy similar en el caso anterior, una persona fue detenida por unos cargos que no tenían totalmente nada que ver, y cuando se entró sus datos en la base, su DNA en la base de datos, pues produjo una coincidencia del 100%. Entonces, cuando le empezaron a interrogar a esta persona sobre este evento, inicialmente él negó que no conocía a Carol, a Karen Stipper, que no la conocía. Sin embargo, después de un tiempo dijo que se acordaba de que él sí la conoció una vez y que ella estaba paseando al perro y que el perro lo mordió a él, el perro de la señora lo mordió y ella le prestó un pañuelo, y que él vio que ella puso el pañuelo en el pantalón y pues que ese fue todo el evento, que eso fue lo que sucedió. Sin embargo, esta prueba pues empezó a generar dudas, se inició la investigación y el caso pues empezó a coger mayor consistencia y finalmente él fue condenado. La defensa consiguió un testigo que apareció 13 años después del juicio del esposo de la señora, diciendo que ella había visto al esposo de la señora Skipper siguiéndola hasta el lugar donde la metió y que ella pues presenció eso. Sin embargo, pues esta testigo es muy dudosa y no se le creyó. Sin embargo, todo esto era simplemente un truco de la defensa para reabrir el caso en contra del señor Skipper y para, digamos, mantener como el sistema andando alrededor de este caso por siempre y por siempre y por siempre, y que a este momento al señor Skipper se le han abierto, luego de su muerte, otra vez 3 casos, o se le ha reabierto la investigación 3 veces, aún estando muerto, solamente con el fin de buscar la forma de cómo de que el sistema judicial declare inocente al verdadero culpable, que se llama John Pop.
One of the major issues over the Skipper case is that originally Karen Skipper's family thought that the police were right and that Philip Skipper had murdered her. They actually, all bar one of them, destroyed photographs of him. They hated him. They were actually glad when he died of cancer. But on his deathbed, his sister asked him, "Did you kill her?" And he said no, moments before he died. Why would he have lied about it at that time? And equally, eventually what happened is the police reinvestigated this case. They found the blood spot again. They had it DNA tested, and it gave a link to John Pope. They also found another blood spot, which was on her knickers, and they So the whole sort of story of this becomes rather difficult to believe, because these are blood spots on intimate parts of her clothing, and it actually relies on her happening to wear the same pair of knickers 3 weeks later and the same pair of jeans 3 weeks after meeting John Pope and this alleged incident with the dog, without having washed either of them. And that is a coincidence which is rather hard to believe. The end result is that Karen Skipper's family were convinced that they'd got it wrong and that Philip Skipper was actually innocent. But then these trials happened. They still believe he's innocent, and they rightly believe that he was innocent. But the trials happened and had an effect. The effect is that his daughter has now grown up. She's 15 years old, and at 13, she had to face a trial, which was turned into a trial of her father for a crime he did not commit. A year later, when she's now 14, she then has to face hearing that her father is responsible again. And then, now aged 15, the retrial occurs, and she has to face this barrage of publicity claiming that her late father has committed this crime. It caused great and terrible distress for her and her mother, and also for Karen Skipper's family. And here is another one of the big problems of the whole system. What are they supposed to do now? They were actually glad when they heard that Philip Skipper had died. They were wrong. They admit that they were wrong. But how are they supposed to deal with their guilt over this now? How are they supposed to rebuild their lives when, in actual fact, nobody has actually gone to them and said, what do you need? What help is required? How can we help you rebuild your lives? How can we help you come to terms with what has happened? This applies not just to Karen Skipper's family, but to Philip Skipper's family as well. There are a number of unseen circumstances or undealt with circumstances. This is one of the things we deal with in another one of our projects called about aftercare, which amazingly we have some provisions to help victims of miscarriages of justice, yet it doesn't apply to people who are clearly innocent. Philip Skipper would never have qualified for it, nor does, and this is the really outrageous situation, even the Cardiff Five, about whom there is no doubt about innocence, or at least should not be any doubt about innocence, due to the conviction of Geoffrey Gaffour, do not actually meet the criteria to get any assistance in rebuilding their lives. The end result of it is two of the Cardiff Five are dead, aged just 49 years old. They did not receive any help in rebuilding their lives. And this is one of the other projects that we sort of work on and need some help over. I will come back to that afterwards, but essentially the situation in relation to the Skipper case is the scientific evidence was fairly strong in suggesting that, one, right from the very start, Philip Skipper should never have been, faced trial, and two, that once they had discovered the DNA in relation to Pope, the scientific evidence was actually fairly strong. There were some errors in the procedures back in 1996, but nothing that actually diminishes the power of the scientific evidence, and eventually it told. So these, and the other thing that is of importance is that in 2009, after the conviction of John Pope, I contacted South Wales Police about this and said, are you going to begin an investigation of what's gone wrong here, like you did in the Lynette White case? And they said no. So, well, why not? Well, one, in 1997, West Midlands Police investigated whether the decision to charge Philip Skipper was justified or not. And their conclusion was that the decision was justified. So I sort of said, hang on a minute, are you seriously relying on an investigation that was 12 years old, And didn't it know that the real perpetrator had actually slipped through your fingers at that time? You're seriously telling me you are relying on that investigation rather than actually investigating whether there were any possible lines of inquiry that were missed originally and lessons that could be learned. And that is essentially one of the major issues about vindication, which is our third major project, which is these are the cases where that you can learn lessons from, that you can get public support for, and you can use to change the criminal justice system for the better and get public confidence restored.
Continuando con este mismo caso, pero lo que quiero resaltar acá es otro de los proyectos que tiene su organización, que se llama Aftercare. Es como, ¿qué es lo que pasa con las personas que sus vidas han sido de cierta forma destruida por estos eventos? Esto viene a lo siguiente, cuando todo esto sucedió, la familia de Karen positivamente pensaba que sí, que el esposo la había matado, y pues le cogieron un odio tremendo y de hecho destruyeron fotos y todas las pertenencias que habían de él para que la hija de él pues no supiera quién era su papá. Sin embargo, cuando se volvieron a abrir los nuevos juicios contra Mr. Skipper, debido a la habilidad de los abogados que estaban defendiendo a Pops, entonces a la hija fue llamada como testigo para preguntarle sobre la relación entre los papás. Pero esos juicios que supuestamente eran contra Pops se volvieron en contra del papá del señor Skipper, y esta niña tuvo que presenciar prácticamente 3 veces cómo volvían a acusar a su papá de haber matado a su madre. Sin embargo, cuando ya toda la evidencia se empezó a consolidar, pues la familia se dio cuenta del grave error que estaba cometiendo, y pues obviamente es una familia que está totalmente destrozada. El proyecto que ellos tienen de Aftercare es buscar como una reparación de ese daño hecho, porque si bien es cierto, el sistema ha reconocido que cometió errores, no ha hecho hasta el momento nada para ayudarles a estas familias a reconstruir sus vidas, ¿no? Lo mismo sucedió con las 5 de Cardiff, que tampoco pasaron en la cárcel 16 años de su vida pagando por un crimen que no cometieron, y luego eso pues simplemente los soltaron, pero nunca hubo ninguna reparación. En este momento pues a la policía se le solicitó que investigara el por qué, cuando se hizo la investigación contra el señor Skipper, qué pasó, por qué las cosas fueron mal y por qué no ampliaron sus posibilidades de encontrar el real culpable. Y pues la policía simplemente dice que en ese momento la investigación estaba bien fundamentada y que por lo tanto no es necesario hacer una investigación de qué sucedió en ese momento, y que pues en ese momento eso era lo que había, lo que tenían, y que estaba todo perfectamente bien fundamentado para llevarlo a la corte. Estas son algunas de las lecciones que se deben aprender de los casos de absolución.
I'll now take questions for 10 minutes, and then I'd like to ask you something.
We have just 10 more minutes.
Right, in that case, 7.5 minutes, and then I'll ask you something.
Yeah, okay.